Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey guys, welcome to another edition of Talking Metal. My name is Mark Striegel. I'd like to thank you for listening to the episode and to listening to Talking Metal. We are approaching 500. It's going to be a fun, somewhat special episode, I think. No major surprises, but I think it's going to be a fun one that you guys are going to enjoy. We do a couple fun little things on it. So stay tuned for that. On today's show, we have Bob Nalbandian, who is the man behind a film documentary called Inside Metal. He's going to tell us all about it. He also is looking for the heavy metal hard rock community to show their support and help him get it in theaters. We're going to have links up to the page you can go to pledge money and donate money to support this film. Bob's going to tell us about what that money will do in the production of this film. Actually, it's more about getting it into theaters. But Bob will fill you in on all the details. I saw a screener copy of this, and it looks great. It's a fun watch. So I hope everyone can get to see it either in the theaters or on DVD at some point in the future. Again, it's called Inside Metal. And before we get into that interview with Bob, because it is a long one, I want to remind you that this episode of Talking Metal, and all episodes lately of Talking Metal, are sponsored by Defenders of the Old Festival 3. We have a link up to their Facebook page and our show notes on TalkingMetal.com today, and it's going to be a great time in Brooklyn, New York, with Exciter, the reunited Exciter, their first show on U.S. soil, The Rods, High Spirits, and many more. It's going to be a great weekend. I'm going to be there. Defenders of the Old Fest 3 in Brooklyn, New York, March 13th and 14th, 2015. For more information and more of the bands who are going to be playing at the Defenders of the Old Festival, go to today's show notes on TalkingMetal.com for this episode. And the venue they're going to be playing at is the Bell House, by the way. I will be there, and I hope to see you there. Let's get into the episode. This is Rat, Sweet Cheater, followed by my extensive talk with Bob Nalbandian. Hey guys, it's Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and on the line we have Bob Nalbandian. How are you, Bob?
Great. How you doing, Mark?
I'm good. You have a new film out, which is really good, really educational. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. It's called Inside Metal. But first, I want to just talk about you, because the film isn't really necessarily about you. You're occasionally in it, and there's shots of you, and you're asking questions, and you narrate it. But let's talk a little bit about your history, because I think it's very interesting and important in the history of heavy metal. You were a kid growing up in Southern California, correct?
Right.
When all this stuff started happening, and you took to it a little bit earlier than the rest of the country. You were there while it was all blossoming, and you started something called a fanzine, which a lot of our younger listeners might not know what that is. Can you explain what a fanzine is?
Yeah, Mark. I was very fortunate to live right in the heart of LA. I actually lived in Huntington Beach, which is in Orange County, which is about less than an hour south of Los Angeles. So I was up in LA all the time, and I started a metal fanzine. What a fanzine is basically a fan-made magazine. And usually back in the day, although fanzines did get to the point where it was glossy and color, and they still called it fanzines. But back in the early 80s, fanzines were generally known as just Xeroxed magazines. And you would use, this was, you know, way before, you know, the mainstream of home computers and that kind of stuff. So you would use rub off letters and typewriters, you know, to type on the fanzine, and then, you know, put in photos. And it was just a fun time. It was during the days of the early days of tape trading. And, you know, we're talking, you know, 81, 82. I started the magazine in 82, the fanzine, in I think April of 82. And what got me going on it was really Brian Slagle had a fanzine called The New Heavy Metal Review. And this is before he started Metal Blade. And he would sell them he worked at a record store. He was the import buyer at a place called Oz Records, which was in the Valley, which was like the metal haven back in the day.
Okay.
You know, the country club and all great, you know, venues out there, and tons of great record stores. And, you know, that got him started to do the first Metal Massacre. Actually, you know, Metal Blade was just basically started from a metal compilation, the first Metal Massacre, that obviously, as you know, had you know, ended up having Rat and Metallica and Black and Blue and, you know, a lot of great bands. That kind of what kickstarted it. But the fanzine that really got me interested was out of the Bay Area, a guy by the name of Ron Quintana, who is an underground metal Bay Area metal guru, and he started a magazine called Metal Mania. And I saw that, and it was more my speed, where it was just Xerox. Brian's magazine was a little bit slick, you know, even for fanzine standards. But Metal Mania, he had handwritten stuff in there, and it was all typed and photos sewn all over and just chock full of metal information and all the great underground stuff. And it's like, wow, you know, I could do this. This is something I could do. And we were all pen pals. We all kind of knew each other. And, you know, my very close friend, Pat Scott, who lived in Huntington Beach with me, was very close with Lars Ulrich. He had met Lars around the time Lars had just moved into Newport Beach, which is about 10, 15 minutes from Huntington Beach. So Pat would take me over to Lars's house, and Lars would make us, and this is before Metallica. He was just this metal kid from Denmark who had the ultimate metal collection. He was so into the new wave of British heavy metal, and he had all the Japanese imports of bands like, you know, Japanese band like Bow Wow and all the stuff that was super hard to find. And he had Japanese imports of LA bands. I remember seeing he had Legs Diamond and the Runaways and Yesterday and Today all on like Japanese imports. And I'm like, you know, how does this guy from Denmark know these bands? I mean, he was just this uber metal fan. And, you know, this was just a great period. This was during the whole tape trading fanzine kind of thing where everyone traded the demos, you know, Metallica formed the Kill 'Em All demo was being traded. And, you know, you were getting to hear bands like, you know, of course, bands like Maiden were starting to come around, and Saxon had Wheels of Steel that was released domestically. Motorhead with Ace of Spades was released out here. And then you had all these great underground imports, you know, Diamond Head and Angel Witch and Tank. And we were trading these demos and BBC sessions and live recordings of these, you know, great bands. And I would send them all these great LA bands. And, you know, one of the bands that's featured heavily in the documentary was Snow. They had an EP out, a 10-inch EP, which, you know, I found that was like the ultimate EP for people in Europe to own. It was the equivalent of the Iron Maiden Soundhouse tapes here. You know, if you had the Soundhouse tapes, which, you know, is extremely rare, they were vying for like the Snow EP, which was extremely rare. And I found out that all these pen pals I had through, you know, Kerrang, through the pen pal section and Kerrang, all these, you know, people that ended up writing for, you know, Metal Forces and all these different European and British magazines, they all love the LA scene. And I was actually honestly more into the European metal, the new wave of British heavy metal, but also was a fan of the LA scene. And it's like, wow, I'm right here in LA. So I'm recording, you know, and back then it was cool to bootleg club shows, and the bands loved it. I would, you know, go in and bootleg an Armored Saint show or August Red Moon show, and they would encourage it because they knew I would get it out to millions of fans overseas. And then all of a sudden they're getting letters from Belgium and Holland and, you know, England, and, you know, they were appearing in fanzines. So that was how it was done before the internet.
And yeah. And, you know, I can totally relate to what you're saying. I was probably a few years later, but growing up in the Chicago area, I would go to the Holiday Inn in like Downers Grove, Illinois, where they'd have record swaps, and we would go in there and buy tapes of, you know, bands that we'd never heard of that the vendors were telling us were good, and a lot of times we'd discover great stuff. It was just such a different world back then, and fanzines were a big part of my life at that time. And your fanzine was called The Headbanger, and guys, you can definitely find it online if you do some searching. I think it's actually on iTunes.
Yeah, we got on iTunes and Amazon. I think we put just the first two issues up, which is pretty embarrassing. I was like 17 and 18 at the time, and boy, was my writing bad. But
yeah,
but
it's charming, and it has like a real feel to it. I mean, I was chuckling as I read the review of the Rat concert. Now, this is Rat before anybody even heard of Rat outside of probably your area. This is 1982. You reviewed one of their shows, and it sounds like it was a very, very different, somewhat different band than we all came to know.
Yeah, I think my partner actually reviewed that. And
oh, did he? Okay.
A fairly bad review, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it's a terrible review. Yeah.
But I, you know, it's funny because I did used to see Rat back then, and some of those early shows, and, you know, to be honest, some of the early Metallica shows, their first shows, they weren't very good. I mean, Metallica just boomed. They started in their second show. They actually opened up for Saxon on the Denim and Leather when they came over to the Whiskey, and Rat opened one of the shows, and Metallica did, and that was Metallica's second show. No one had heard of the band, and you know, they were quite rusty, and a lot of these bands were kind of rusty at the time. But it was cool, and I ended up really liking Rat. I saw Rat several times opening up for Motley Crue in the clubs, and I think I saw them, I don't think I ever saw them with Jakey Lee, but they had all different players in the band before Warren DeMartini and Robin Crosby came around, and they were much heavier. I mean, if you hear like Tell the World from the Metal Massacre record, and even the first EP, it's quite a bit heavier than.
Oh, I love that first Rat EP, like Sweet Cheater. I mean, that's just, it's so rockin' and raw. And as much, you know, I love Out of the Cellar too. I think it's a really great record. However, that EP, and Rat isn't the only band where their first EP was a little more street sounding and a little more raw and real. You know, that EP just captures a real attitude that some of the future Rat stuff wouldn't quite grab a hold of.
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing about the LA scene, because everyone thinks of, you know, the LA metal scene You know, everyone thinks of the glam bands and stuff, but it wasn't really glam before that. It was when MTV started exposing these bands. That's when they kind of softened up their sound, did the ballads and did all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the poofed up hair. I mean, they still kind of had that image. Motley always had that image, but it was definitely more street, you know, leather, you know, leather and chains, you know, kind of image. And even Rat too. I mean, the first Great White EP, as you know, is much heavier. And there used to be a band called Dante Fox, which was Jack Russell, Mark Kendall, and this crazy bass player named Don Costa and Tony Richards, who ended up playing in Wasp. And, you know, the bands were much heavier then. I think once they got signed to major labels, their labels really wanted to get them a little bit more commercialized. And I think, you know, seeing the success of bands like Def Leppard on you know, the High and Dry album, and then, of course, Pyromania, you know, that really convinced the labels to, you know, really capture that kind of sound. But yeah, right. it was quite a bit heavier back then.
Well, let's even go back before that and get into the film a little bit. Again, the film, guys, is called Inside Metal, The Pioneers of LA Hard Rock and Metal. Now, when I read these heavy metal history books, and believe me, my bookshelves are just filled with them, they always tend to claim there was no real hard rock scene before the explosion on the strip in the early 80s. You know, there was Van Halen and Quiet Riot, and a lot of these history books kind of say, hey, that was it. Really wasn't much else going on in the hard rock world in Los Angeles pre-1980, except those two bands. But your documentary paints a very different picture. You bring to light a lot that there was actually a lot of other stuff going on. Absolutely. Wolfgang, Smile, Detective, all sorts of bands. The Boys, right? That was the George Lynch one. Snow, who you mentioned earlier. So let's talk about some of these, because I got, you know, like a band like Detective, I'm embarrassed to say I didn't really know who they were. And I've gone online and been searching out their stuff, and wow, some great stuff. I mean, let's start with Detective. This is a band that's featured in Bob's documentary, and they were on Swan Song, the Swan Song label, the Led Zeppelin label, very tied in with the Zeppelin guys.
Yeah.
How big were they on the LA scene, and what year are we talking about?
Well, this might have been a little earlier. I think they started around 75. And first, let me say, I totally agree with what you're saying. A lot of the books have never talked about this. And
they always say Van Halen, and then there was Quiet Riot. I mean, exactly. I don't want to. I mean, I can actually think of a couple really respected authors who've basically said, oh, those were the only two bands in the scene in, you know, 1976.
Well, you know, if you didn't grow up in LA during that time, you wouldn't know. And I've even talked to, you know, people that I respect heavily that I look up to, like a Martin Popoff, and he wasn't even familiar with these. And I thought Martin knew everything, but a lot of these bands didn't have records. It was before MTV. It was before, you know, long before internet. So a lot of these bands just fell by the wayside, but it was a big scene. But Detective were one of the bigger bands, and they were actually not a local LA band, so to speak. They were kind of touted to be the next super group. Michael DeBar came over from England, and he was a part of that big glam scene that came over from England with, you know, T-Rex and Sweet and Humble Pie. I mean, they sound a little bit more like a Humble Pie. His vocals was very Steve Marriott. He was in a band called Silverhead that were signed to Deep Purple's record label, Purple Records. And, you know, you may know him. He ended up marrying Pamela DeBar.
Right, of course. Of course.
Right. Yeah, and definitely. So he was.
And didn't he have like more a commercial rock vibe in the, like later in the 80s or, you know, in
well,
the 80s?
Yeah. He did. After Detective, he went to join a band called Checkered Pass, which was with Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols. But it was a little bit kind of poppy. And then he replaced Robert Palmer in Power Station.
Right.
So he's definitely had a very diverse career. And, you know, Detective were not a metal band. I think the thing that was confusing with Detective is no one could figure out what kind of band they were. They were blues. They were, you know, hard rock. They dressed kind of almost new wave-ish, all with suits and kind of short hair.
Well, there's that one song I was listening to, Grim Reaper, which
love that song.
Which very Zeppelin-esque in my opinion. And, you know, being on the Swan Song label, and I think it's in your film, they mentioned that they were talking to Jimmy Page about producing the record, but that never happened or something.
Yeah, they signed they got one of the biggest deals. Swan Song only had a couple bands. He had Bad Company, and I think they had like Robert Palmer, but I think that might have been afterwards. But Detective was Michael DeBar and Michael Monarch, who was from Steppenwolf, who of course were a huge band from the late 60s into the early 70s, you know, Magic Carpet Ride, Born to Be Wild, obviously. And so they figured, you know, tying these two guys together with this fantastic drummer, John Hyde, very John Bonham-ish kind of drummer, and very diverse lineup. They had a black bass player, Bobby Pickett, amazing bass player. And then they added a keyboard player, Tony Kaye from Yes. So kind of odd, you know, having a progressive keyboardist with, you know, kind of a blues. So it was a very, but they were kind of touted to be a super group. They released two records, their debut, which had Grim Reaper and a song called One More Heartache, which again, very Zeppelin-esque. It starts with a total John Bonham-ish drum beat. And they were kind of radio hits in the early, or I should say mid to late 70s. On a couple of the radio stations. I remember hearing it on the radio, and they just never really broke. I think people were kind of confused. You know, is this a rock band with their look? And, you know, and this is when New Wave was starting to become big. So they ended up breaking up. But a lot of bands, you know, Quiet Riot opened up for them back in the, of course, Randy Rhoads' version of Quiet Riot. A lot of the local bands kind of got their springboard opening up for bands like Detective. And this was, you know, Detective could be similar to a New York band who I'm sure you know, Stars.
Oh, absolutely.
Around the same era, they released, you know, three, you know, great records, very underground. I think they had a big New York following. But anywhere else in the country, and another band is Legs Diamond that were signed before Van Halen. They had two or three albums out on Mercury, Firepower and A Diamond is a Hard Rock, and a fantastic band. But they just kind of, it's weird because certain places like in San Antonio, Texas, they're huge. Yeah. They would play because of certain radio stations. I think, you know, they talk about in the movie, certain radio stations could play songs. It wasn't like it is today, all corporate. So if a radio station liked a band, like say a Legs Diamond, they would play it. And so for whatever reason, San Antonio, same with the band Riot, the New York band Riot, they were huge in San Antonio. So you had certain pockets where these bands were kind of big.
Depending on the support they were getting from radio in those towns. Usually,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Remember, you didn't have MTV then. MTV became the national radio station. When you were on MTV, you were on everywhere nationally, you know. Before then, it was, you know, specific markets, you know, that you could be big in. So Detective had a few different markets in L.A. I don't think they really did much in back east. I mean, John Hyde talks about in the story once, you know, they were touring and they had AC/DC open for them. And wow. He had never heard of AC/DC. And he sees, you know, these guys come out in Angus in his shorts. And he's like, what the hell is this? Then he saw them play. He's like, fuck, I don't even want to go on stage. These guys, there's no way we could, you know, compete with this. So, you know, great stories like this. So that kind of tells you how long ago it was, because bands like AC/DC were club bands. They used to play the Starwood. Rush used to play the Starwood. Judas Priest used to play the Starwood. I think Aerosmith actually did a couple shows at the Starwood, kind of like private shows. Cheap Trick used to play the Starwood. Stars used to play the Starwood. So all these bands were almost kind of like equals, you know, with the Van Halens and with bands like Smile and Legs Diamond and all that.
Yeah, and let's talk about some of those bands. I quickly wanted to tell the listeners that there's a great story from the drummer of Detective that's in your film, where he talks about actually jamming with the guys in Led Zeppelin, and there's a couple really cool Zeppelin-esque stories that he tells in the Inside Metal film. But let's jump over to Smile and talk about them. I mean, this is another band I really was not too aware of. Maybe I'd heard the name once or twice, but let's talk about Smile and how they went on to influence the scene.
Well, Smile was, I think they started around 75, 76, and they became a pretty big band in the Starwood, primarily the Starwood, which was the big club at the time. And they were competing a lot with Van Halen was just starting to take off. So it was like Smile and Quiet Riot, the Randy Rhoads version of Quiet Riot, were kind of the bands vying to be the next band to get signed. And Smile was a little bit more poppy. They were a great live band. They did a record, I think, that they finally got signed in like the late or the early 90s. They did a record for MCA Curb, which, to be honest, the band can't stand. And it's just way overproduced. When it came to that era, you know, you had the labels totally trying to make them into something they're not. But it's not a very good representation of the band. They were a really good live band. I remember seeing them back in the day a few times. Again, a little bit more poppy, a little bit more commercial, but great frontman, Scotty Waller. The drummer, people cited as one of the best drummers around, Jimmy Volpe. Who later actually played with Warrior. He was on the Fighting for the Earth album with Joe Floyd, our co-producer.
Yeah, great record. Great. Yeah, I love Warrior. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Smile was definitely a band that just never got their break. You know, I think once Van Halen hit, you know, the new wave band started. It became, you know, at that time, this is before, like I said, before MTV. So you didn't have that copycat mentality where how the labels were after, you know, once, you know, Van Halen and Quiet Riot and all those bands started to do well, then boom, the LA metal scene exploded, which will be on the next title we'll talk about, you know, when bands like, you know, Wasp and Black and Blue and Rat and, you know, Armored Saint, all the bands started, you know, getting signed. But back then, if you had one band.
Now, when you say the next title, so there'll be a part two to this?
Yes, I wanted to kind of clarify this is the Inside Metal is going to be an ongoing series.
Oh, and okay. I did not know that. Good.
Yeah, yeah. It's the Inside LA Metal is going to be a three-part trilogy, and each is going to be two DVDs because there's just so much material. So, you know, the Pioneers of LA Hard Rock and Metal is basically from 1975 to 1981. It's a two DVD set. The second title is going to be The LA Metal Scene Explodes, and that's going to be 1982 to roughly 1986.
Cool.
And that will be, of course, a lot of the bands you're familiar with, you know, basically when the scene exploded, when MTV came into play, when the label started signing the bands, you know, the Rats, Motleys, Quiet Riot, Rough Cut, Black and Blue, even, you know, like the Racer X, the Leather Wolf, Warrior, Malice, you know, yeah.
Love all those bands.
Yeah, Lizzie Borden. Yeah, so that was really when the scene exploded and when people started to get familiar with LA. And we're going to kind of stop it at that point because I think from 86 on, when the Poisons and the Warrants and all those bands, the Slaughters, that's kind of been – the story's been told.
Right.
And it really wasn't what I was into. And it did get kind of ridiculous as it was told in Penelope Spheres' movie that she did Decline Part 2.
Right.
And you know, there's enough DVDs about that, enough behind the musics about that. So I wanted to commit more to the underground. So our third title is going to actually be The Rise of LA Thrash Metal, because I really wanted to, concentrate, because there were so many great LA thrash bands and power metal bands that kind of got pushed to the wayside because LA was, you know, when people thought LA metal, they thought glam, you know, and so the glam scene took precedence. So, San Francisco ended up getting all the glory for the thrash bands. But, you know, you look at three out of the big four bands, you know, Megadeth, Slayer, and of course Metallica, they're all originally LA bands.
Totally.
So many other great bands. You know, you got Hyrax, you got Abattoir, Agent Steel, Dark Angel, you know, so we interview all these bands, Cryptic Slaughter. So, yeah, I really wanted to tell the story, Mark, like you say, a story that hasn't been told. There's no point for me to do a movie that's been told before. I want to kind of turn people on to a scene that and bands that they may not have heard of, or, you know, kind of, wow, this is a whole different meaning to LA than I thought, because like I said, LA is huge. You know, you have Orange County, you have the Valley, you got Pasadena, you got the South Bay, but everyone thinks Hollywood, and right. Hollywood was a glam scene. You know, it was primarily glam, but there was a lot of great heavy bands, you know, from LA, and hopefully we could do, you know, continue on and do some inside. You know, I love to do inside New York metal. As you know, there's so many great bands. You know, Riot, as we mentioned, Stars. Yep. You had the Rods, Manowar, Twisted Sister, of course, and then you had even underground bands like the Good Rats, and you know, so many bands. Virgin Steel out of the New York area. Mm-hmm. And you know, people think Twisted Sister and so many of the big bands, but you know, I love that. And I used to collect demos, and I remember all these bands, you know, when they came out. And I think these bands should be documented, and because they were great and they were big. I mean, the scene in LA before the Motleys and the Rats and all that was huge. Starwood. Right. Was, you know, a 700 seat venue. You would have yesterday and today come down all the time from the Bay Area. They used to play at least once a month. They would do three nights at the Starwood, you know, Legs Diamond, the same, Snow and A La Carte and Quiet Riot with Randy Rhoads. I mean, these bands were unsigned, you know, packing out, you know, 700-800 seat venues. So it was, and you know, I don't know how it is in New York, but here in LA, the club scene is dead. There is no scene. All the clubs have washed up. There's no more Key Club. They're closing down the House of Blues here in LA. There's no live music scene. The scene is completely dead. And
I mean, in New York, there is definitely a music scene, but it's very, very far away from metal. And it takes place in Brooklyn, New York, which is over the past 10 to 15 years has become this real hipster hotbed artist musician scene. But the metal scene, I mean, there actually are a couple metal bars and clubs in Williamsburg, Brooklyn now, but it's I wouldn't call it a scene. It's more like
it's not like the Ritz or the Roseland.
No, right? Yeah, Roseland actually closed down. Yeah. So the metal scene in New York, I don't actually think is all that healthy right now.
I think everywhere, pretty much in the States. I mean, in Europe, it's booming. You know?
Right,
it's
Sweden, Scandinavia, especially. It's just Germany, massive. Yeah, over.
Yeah. But yeah. You know, in the States, it's sad, and it's. I don't think it's ever going to come back. I mean, a lot of people say, "Oh, Bob, you're going to bring back the scene," and it's not coming back. I mean, let's be honest. It's never going to be like it was. I mean, especially with today's standard, with the cell phones and the YouTube and this and that, people just don't go out to shows like they did in the past. But I at least want to present, and a lot of the younger bands that came out to the screenings that we had, they were just blown away, and they're going back listening to, and hopefully it'll influence some of the younger bands to get out there and play and build a following. And, you know, whether it's a backyard party or a bar or whatever, just, you know, kind of bring that feeling back,
bring the excitement back, definitely.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Bob, before we go any further here, because I could talk to you all night about this stuff, but let's talk about the fan support, the support that's needed to get this movie into theaters. There is a place that people can go, a fan-backed page, right? Do you have that web address?
Yeah, metalrockfilms.com. And I want to thank you, Mark. I saw, even before we got in contact, I saw on the contributors that you donated a healthy donation to the page. And I want to thank you personally.
Yeah, well, my good friend Mitch LaFon told me about the movie and sent me a trailer. And I was so impressed that I had to give a little something. So I encourage all the Talking Metal listeners to go to metalrockfilms.com. We will have that link through today's show notes on talkingmetal.com, and go over and, you know, whatever you can give, whether it's $5 or $100, you know, make a donation and let's help get this story out to the masses.
And we do have good prizes, or I guess gifts, we should call it, for each donation you make. We got signed DVDs, signed posters, and different tiers, so to speak, for the donations. We got like a gold record plaque. You know, you could have your name credited in the movie. So, you know, for your donations, you will get something back. And what the donations are basically for, Mark, is for this theater run. when we put this together, we weren't really expecting the executive producer, Warren Croyle, started the company Metal Rock Films. He's got a huge DVD network, huge. They do a lot of not just music, but tons of, you know, conspiracy movie DVDs and just a huge network that he does. When we put this together, we didn't really even think about the theaters, but at the screening, we had a guy by the name of Doug Cluthie from DRK Productions came out and he presented, he says, you know, he brought a lot of these Sam Dunn movies, like the Rush movie. And I believe he's working on he's doing the Guns N' Roses 3D movie to the theaters.
Oh, okay.
So cool. He's, you know, got a great name and he says, dude, I'd love to take this to the theaters. And we said, yeah, this would be fantastic. But obviously, it wasn't really in our budget. It's pretty expensive to, you know, rent up theaters and, you know, because you have to rent out kind of the independent theaters to do something like this and do the proper promotion. And so we got Chipster PR behind us, as you know, and we have Bob Chapardi, who runs the Fanback page. And you probably remember Bob from Concrete Marketing. He did the Foundations Forum.
Sure.
So he's like the metal marketing guru. And we got them involved to kind of do a crowdfunding campaign to help us basically pay for the screenings, because I think, you know, to have this on the big screen and to bring it to the people before it comes out on DVD, you know, it's a great thing. And what we would want to do is make it real special, do kind of a Q&A afterwards, and just make it a really cool event where the people could meet, you know, say a Steven Quadros or a Carlos Cavazo who was in Snow before Quiet Riot, or a Don Dokken, or, you know, that kind of thing. So that's kind of what we're aiming for. And we've already, Doug's already booked several theaters, but the more money we could raise in the fan back campaign, and we've got about, I believe, about 25 days left or so, the more theaters we could hit and the more special we could make the event. So I want the people to know every penny that is going into this fan back campaign is going to be used toward the promotion and marketing for the theaters. So it's definitely a good cause, and it's great, not just for this movie, but I think for the whole heavy metal cause in general, just to get it out nationally.
Yeah. I mean, it's a part of history that needs to be told. So definitely, guys, go support Bob and the movie Metal Rock Films, or I'm sorry, at metalrockfilms.com. The movie is Inside Metal. So many great interviews. We're talking major stars, guys. Lars Ulrich is in this movie. Stephen Piercy, Don Dokken, Chris Holmes. I mean, let's talk about Chris Holmes. Chris Holmes, every time I see him, he doesn't appear in public much.
Yeah.
But when he does, it's a complete disaster. Yeah. and mess. And people laugh and make fun of his unfinished music videos and his drunken interviews. However, in your movie, he's great.
Yeah.
He tells a great story about having Eddie Van Halen at his house and opening the windows, hoping people would think it was him. And he sounds coherent. He sounds almost, I hate to say, but normal.
Yeah.
You know, what is Chris like in real life?
Well, you know,
is he this out of control character that we all kind of have been programmed to think he is, or is he more normal, like he appears in your film?
He's a real sweet guy, and I've always been I've always loved Chris Holmes with Wasp. I love those first couple Wasp albums. I love the album Kill Fuck Die that he came back on. Again, some of the movies the videos he's done is embarrassing. It's like, dude. So I really wanted to show the good, because I've talked to him before. I think people love, you know, people love the tragedy, and people love to put people like that down, especially, you know, musicians that have had hard times, whether they be on drugs and whatever. And, you know, but I always had kind of a soft spot for Chris, and a good friend, Gina Zamparelli, who was very instrumental in helping out, getting people like Stephen Piercy and Chris Holmes on this. And I told her in the beginning, because I know Chris loves to slag off, you know, Wasp and Blackie, and, you know, he kind of got a bitter taste in his mouth, which is understandable. And I said, you know, it's not about that. Let's talk. I know Chris and Eddie were good friends. I want to sit down, talk to Chris about those times. So she got with Chris and told him what this is about. And we kind of prepared that in a way just so he knew. And you know, all the people that we talked about, they love talking about this era. You know, Steve Plunkett from, you know, Wolfgang, who, you know, was later obviously an Autograph, and all Don Dokken and all these people that, God, nobody talks about this, Bob. This was such a great era. So all these people were real happy to talk about this. And I think Chris was too. It was something that, you know, fond memories that he had, you know, jamming in his bedroom with Eddie Van Halen and, you know, just some of the great times then. So I think once we started talking, you know, the artists really loosened up. I think at first they were a little bit skeptical, and, you know, then we got together, and it was just, we're just, you know, talking metal, basically talking, you know, just bullshitting. And I think once they kind of saw the angle, they kind of loosened up, and then it just kind of flowed. The stories just started coming out of them. And that's what I really wanted is the history, you know, to tell the people what I wanted, to bring the viewer back to 1978 or 79. You know, I mean, I love those kind of movies, and not even necessarily the music movies. I mean, there's that great documentary that Stacey Peralta did on skateboarding, Dogtown.
I've seen that.
Which was fantastic because it's got all that old video footage from the 70s, and the soundtrack back then was all metal. You know, everyone thinks, oh, skateboard punk. No, back then, all those, you know, Stacey Peralta and Tony Alva, it was all Zeppelin, Aerosmith, Ted Nugent. And I remember that as a young kid in Huntington Beach. That was, you know, surfer and skateboard capital. And I go, wow, I want to do that with metal. I mean, it just really brings you back to that era, you know, of the 70s. And that's why we got some great original footage from the Starwood of bands like Snow and A La Carte and Smile and Quiet Riot with Rhodes and, you know, which was real hard to find to come by because this is like old film footage and stuff. But, you know, we had some great people, Alan Wood, that really helped us out immensely and getting a lot of this stuff. Kevin Estrada, who donated so many fantastic photos. So we had a great team of people. And as I mentioned, my co-producer, Joe Floyd, who did all the camera work, he was in Warrior and he was very instrumental in.
Was he the guitar player?
He was a guitarist. He's the brainchild of Warrior. He basically pretty much is Warrior. And they're back together doing stuff. And everyone loves Joe. He's been an audio engineer for years. So once a lot of these musicians knew that Joe was involved, like, oh, fuck, I love Joe. Yeah, Joe's great. So that kind of opened up a lot of things. And Carl Alvarez, who was my other co-producer, helped out immensely. And Curtis Don Vito and Robert Gaston, the associate producers who edited the movie, they all grew up on this. So we all had this passion about it. So it was a great team. And of course, Warren Croyle, who goes way back, he used to be in LA. He used to work alongside Andy Johns as an engineer. And so he's, you know, he was familiar. Everyone got what I was trying to do and everyone agreed this is something that's got to be put out, and which is fantastic. Cause if I was to do this with someone like a VH1 or a bigger company, you know, they would have stipulations. Well, this band isn't big enough. Nobody knows about this, or you can't, you know, but this was fantastic. Cause it was like, it was just an open drawing board for me to include the bands. And the great thing is we did get the Lars Ulrichs and the Don Dokkens and the Carlos Cavazos and the Stephen Piercy's, but it was important for me to get the Stephen Quadros and the Brian O'Brien and the Greg Leons and the, you know, the people that Scotty Wallers, that people may not be familiar with, but in that era, they were just as important, you know? So.
Yeah. Totally. We're going to have everything linked through today's show notes on talkingmetal.com. Metalrockfilms.com is the website. So guys, please support Bob and Inside Metal. Bob, before I let you go, let me ask you a couple off-the-beaten-path Van Halen questions. I want to ask you about Randy Rhoads specifically. Now, you were in the scene back then. Did Randy Rhoads' playing change drastically after he heard Van Halen?
No, actually, they were around the same time. And to be I wish I was around that era. I mean, I was a little bit too young to catch Randy Rhoads with Quiet Riot or Van Halen. I saw a lot of the bands coming into Orange County at the time because I was like 15, 16. I wasn't able to drive out to LA, but I did catch Dubrow, which was right after Randy joined Ozzy. And that was, I believe Greg Leon was playing guitar with Kevin Dubrow. And then they, of course, changed their name back to Quiet Riot and did the Mental Health album and, you know, what everyone remembers. But no, I think actually Randy and Eddie, they came around the same time. And, I think Kelly Garney really tells the story well. Kelly Garney was the original bass player for Quiet Riot before Rudy Sarzo, and he was Randy's best friend. And he said that Van Halen kind of dominated the Pasadena area and Quiet Riot kind of dominated the valley, which was west of Pasadena, and they all vied to conquer Hollywood. So it was a big competition. So they both started around the same time. So I think, you know, really Eddie Van Halen, George Lynch, Dave Medichetti, Randy Rhoads, they're all from the same era. They were all battling it out, you know, at the same time. And, you know, Van Halen used to open up for Y&T a lot. And they opened up for certain shows with the Wolfgang. So, you know, this.
Yeah. And that one famous show they did, I mean, there were a lot of famous shows, but the show Gene Simmons went to see, he was actually there to see George Lynch's band, I think.
Yeah, that's the story. He went to see, I think it was actually Exciter, because they were a big band. If you know, like, songs like Paris is Burning, and a lot of the songs from the real heavy songs from the first Dokken album, a lot of those were old Exciter songs. And, you know, people like Brian Slagle and a lot of people say they were like the heaviest band. I never actually caught Exciter, but yeah, the rumor is Gene went to see Exciter or he saw George Lynch. And then the next time he saw Exciter, I believe Van Halen was opening and he saw this kid, Eddie Van Halen. He's like, shit, man, I prefer Eddie Van Halen over George. And that's supposedly how Van Halen got discovered by Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. So, yeah, great. A lot of great stories like that. But, I think Randy Rhoads when Randy Rhoads was in Quiet Riot, Quiet Riot was very poppy. They weren't really a metal band. They were more pop. And I think, Carlos,
you know, cause on those first two Quiet Riot records, the Japanese releases,
right?
He doesn't shred and it almost sounds like he's not at the technical level that he would be a few years later with Ozzy.
Yeah, I think, you know, like what Carlos Cavazos says in the documentary, it wasn't until, you know, he joined Ozzy where, you know, Carlos realized how fantastic he was. I think he kind of held back a lot. I think that was, you know, Kevin Dubrow wanted Quiet Riot to be a real kind of a poppy band. And I think Eddie Van Halen definitely brought in the guitar shredding. I mean, even the first couple Yesterday and Today records, Struck Down and their first album, didn't have that much guitar shredding. I mean, when that first Van Halen album came out, and that's why there was so much talk about Van Halen, because it really was that important and that pivotal, because that was the first album that was just guitar overload, you know, before Yngwie, before the guitar shredders. That album set the benchmark. And before that, you know, you had the Montrose album, you had, you know, Ritchie Blackmore, Page, all these guys. No one did a guitar solo like, you know, Eruption, you know, on a record. It was kind of unheard of. I mean, you heard little stints of, like, you know, Queen and like Brighton Rock, you know, Brian May will do his little thing, but nothing like what Eddie did and what Eddie portrayed. So he definitely took it to the next level. And it was, you know, just that opened the door, obviously. I think when that first Van Halen record came out, I think that's when really Lynch and all these other people really said, okay, we got to step it up, man. And it was all about that, just stepping up your game, man. When a guitar player came around and you saw him doing something, it was a big competition. You know, Greg Leon was right in that mix too, you know.
Now, David Lee Roth was obviously in this scene, hung out with these guys, played gigs with these guys. And when I say these guys, I mean Kevin Dubrow, Quiet Riot. I mean, even in the later years, he would party with Stephen Piercy. And yet, after all these other bands started to break many years later, he was so derogatory and always put down the LA hard rock and metal bands that followed after Van Halen.
Yeah,
why do you think that was? Why did he want to separate himself from these guys?
I think it's jealous. I think he always thought he was special, and he was. I mean, there's no question about it. He was the top, you know, he was a front man. But back in the day, if you know, a lot of people say, and you know, Steve Plunkett said this, and a lot of people have said this, he ripped off Jim Dandy. He wanted to be like Jim Dandy. If you hear some of the old Van Halen stuff, if you've heard the old demos and stuff, he's all over the place screaming. And I think people don't realize how important Ted Templeman was to Van Halen. That first album, I mean, you could hear the old demos and the live stuff, and Van Halen's all over the place. I mean, the band is shredding. You know, Eddie Van Halen shredding, but I mean, David Lee Roth is all over the place, you know, with a wow, you know what? I think Ted Templeman really honed him into, you know, just do it here, do it here, you know, really minimizing that sound. So, I think he had a big structure, and I think David Lee Roth, once Van Halen broke, cause it was a very competitive vibe. Like I said, all these guys were vying for the deal, and Van Halen got it and they just took off. And I think that was kind of his way of keeping the other bands down. I don't really know. I mean, it would have been great to talk to Van Halen. We approached him and we had a great conversation with Michael Anthony. I thought he would do it, but, I think his wife kind of, I think she manages, like, is his personal manager, and she was a little bit against. She loved the idea. She goes, "Oh, Smile. Oh, God, these bands. I remember all these bands. This is great that you're doing it." She was really positive about it. But I think at that point, she didn't want, you know, him talking Van Halen or to go back into the whole Van Halen thing. So she never got back with us at the end, which was a shame, because it would have been great to get, obviously, Van Halen's point of view. And the Runaways, too, were another band that I thought we were going to get, and we just couldn't lock them down. And timing was a big part of it. You know, we didn't have a huge budget. We couldn't fly around like, you know, like someone like a Sam Dunn does, you know, to do interviews. We did most of them here in L.A. So if a band was out on tour, it was kind of difficult. But, yeah, the Van Halen thing, I that always bugged me about David Lee Roth.
I mean, there's just so many stories. Even Axl Rose, when he was on the Eddie Trunk show many years ago, told stories about hanging out with David Lee Roth. He was definitely friendly with these guys. He partied with these guys. They played gigs together. But yet, in front of the press, he always would diminish them.
Well, I think that was, and that was the key thing, too, because, I mean, and that was the thing about rock and metal. And that's what kept it on the edge in a way. It's just kind of the same thing with the Axl Rose and you remember the Vince Neil dispute they had, you know, "I'm going to kick your ass." Who knows if that was made for the press or not, but it's rock and roll. And back then it was super competitive, and they talk about that in the movie. They would be, you know, Brian O'Brien and all the drummers had that competition too, as well as all the guitar players, you know, and Brian O'Brien and Stephen Quadros and Jimmy Volpe, they were all good friends. But when it came to live, it was like, "I'm going to kick your fucking ass. You ain't shit. You know, I'm going to, you know, beat you down. I'm going to, you know," and that was kind of the attitude. So I think they might have been doing a little bit of role playing in the press, but I think a lot of it was real. I mean, these guys, it was a vicious competitive scene. And, you know, especially back then, because you could only have one band. Once one band made it, it was like, okay, you know, the label's, "All right, we already got our metal band. Okay, Van Halen made it. We don't need another Van Halen." Whereas afterwards, I think David Lee Roth got upset that at that time when all the bands started doing this. And truthfully, I mean, you see the Bret Michaels and the Vince Neils and all these guys, everyone took from David Lee Roth, you know, and they admit it. And I think it started to bug him after a while. And I could kind of see that, where the copycat mentality got a little bit too much and people weren't doing their own original thing. But then again, David, like, you know, people said, David took from Jim Dandy from Black Oak, Arkansas. A lot of people had said, and I think Alan Wood said it in the movie, that David Lee Roth used to come to every Smile show and took a lot of stuff from Scotty Waller from Smile. So I can't confirm if that's true or not. That's just what was said in the movie. And I have heard that from several people. And even Scotty kind of said, well, you know, he did do the Russian thing with the splits on stage. And then he saw David Lee Roth doing that on the second album. So who knows, you know, but a lot of it was taken from, you know, you know, taking licks from people like that. And that's why Eddie Van Halen used to play with his back turned when he was doing the hammer-on thing. He would play at the Starwood or at the Whiskey, and when he would do the hammer-ons, he would turn his back to the audience because that was his secret guitar technique that, you know, he didn't want anyone else to use. And then, you know, lo and behold, within a year later, everyone was doing that, you know. So, yeah, it was a whole different game back then, you know. It was, you didn't have guitar instructional videos. I mean, if you wanted to learn a lick, you would have to go out to see the band. You know, you didn't have MTV. You couldn't watch videos. You know, if you're lucky, you might catch one of these bands on Don Kirshner's rock concert at 1 a.m. on a Saturday night, you know, on TV. But that was it. So it was a whole different game then. So it was super competitive. Yeah.
Very good. Great stuff, Bob. And let's get into some Warrior right now. This is Fighting for the Earth. Cool.
We'll be right back. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.